Good morning. Good morning. How you guys doing? Good? Good. Okay, so you all should have received an email yesterday around midnight with sectioning information. Did everyone get that? Yeah? Okay, you should have also gotten an email letting you know that there will not be a section during a lecture. That was an accident. There's no 11 to 12 on Thursday section, so don't sign up for that one because you're not going to get it. I've been receiving a lot of emails, so some of them are like, where should I go tomorrow? You shouldn't go anywhere tomorrow. You don't have a section yet. So just stay up with the emails. You need to section by Friday at 11:59. There are 1,400 of you in the two classes, so that's a lot of people to be sectioning. Please, please sign up by 11:59. Unfortunately, if you don't, you will be randomly assigned to a section. It may be at 7 in the morning on Saturday. I don't know if I have anything to do with it. Really try to get it. So we want to make everyone happy, give you guys all a convenient time. So section by 11:59. If you're not enrolled in the class officially yet, please come see me after class or email me, jglazer@fass. It's really important so that I can section you without the system. So make sure that you send an email to me if you're not officially enrolled or if you have friends who are not officially enrolled, please let them know. And I think that's it. Oh, also for your response papers, you don't have a response paper yet. Some people want to know where to send their response paper. don't send it to me. Tal will be signing your response paper. If you want to send me a diary entry, that's cool. But Tal will be sending out a response paper today, and I think that's it. So if you have questions, just come see me after class. Thanks.
Hi, good morning. So I think this will become a habit that every time I start the class by responding to some of your questions. I've received many emails. As far as I know, I've responded to everyone. If I don't respond to your email within, say, 48 hours, resend it because it might have been lost with all the many emails that I get and sometimes erase automatically. So it's not intentional. I will always respond to your emails, either in person or in class. Also, when you send me an email with a question, some of them I will respond to in class, especially if other people have asked a similar question. And I've been asking until now, can I have permission from you to say your name in class? But what I'd rather do is the other way around. If you don't want me to mention your name in class, write it in the email. So if you just write me an email, is it okay if it's a tacit consent that I assume that it's fine? But if you don't want, just please say specifically, you know, you can respond to this in class, but don't mention my name. It's just, I think it's important to attribute, and especially having been trained as an academic. Otherwise, it's plagiarism. So let me respond to a few things. One of the things that came up, there was an article this week in the Washington Post. A few of you have seen it, or have seen it elsewhere, with the Pew Foundation ran a study on happiness, global study. And they found some interesting stuff. Most of the things aligned with what we talked about. But one different result that they found was that levels of income are correlated with happiness. It doesn't influence happiness, you know, it doesn't account for all of the variance, but it accounts for some of the variance. So some people ask, well, how is this aligned with what we spoke about? Remember the study that I mentioned by Ed Diener. And the answer is that the Pew Foundation ran one study. It got these results. They're interesting results. They will certainly go into the aggregate of studies. But what Diener did and where his results are so powerful is that he ran a meta-analysis. And what does a meta-analysis do? Takes all the studies on this topic using different methodologies, different kinds of questionnaires, some of them measuring objective happiness, you know, through the fMRI and such. And what a meta-analysis does is bring them all together and then aggregates them. And his results found that there was no correlation between happiness levels and income levels. Now, within all the hundreds of studies that he aggregated, there are certain ones that show that there is that there is a correlation. But that's the power of meta-analysis. And the meta-analysis would argue that these are noise as opposed to the essence when you aggregate 100 or hundreds of studies. Having said that, and this is a question that Abdul Reed brought up, how can it be that levels of income don't matter? So here's the thing. Levels of income, in terms of perception, people believe that levels of income matter. If you ask people what is the first thing that you think will make someone happier, they would usually say, good relationship, but the next thing would be probably income. It's measurable, easy to quantify, but that just it doesn't work that way. Yes, it makes us happy initially when we suddenly make 3,000 instead of 1,000, when we move to a beautiful home after having lived with four roommates. It makes a difference initially, but then we very quickly go back to our base level, except for lower income. A homeless person absolutely is affected by low income. No question about that. People who are living in poverty are affected by their income. And certainly controlling for other things, there is a difference between their levels of happiness and the levels of happiness of people who make much more money. But beyond the basic needs, what research over the last, by now, 35 years has shown, income levels matter very little. So here is the question that was asked by a few of you. What's your name? Yes. Vasco, you came to me after class. Sorry, I didn't ask for your permission. Can I use your name, Vasco? Thanks. See, I have to ask permission. So you came to me after class and asked a very important question. Okay, so the external doesn't matter that much. What will that do to our levels of motivation if we really internalized this belief? Will it make us less motivated? Will we push ourselves? Because after all, we are very much motivated. Unfortunately, but it's a fact of life, we are motivated by things like grades. We are motivated by things like status, prestige, accolades. Again, part of being human. We are all motivated by these things as well. So what if we really internalize the message that these things, yes, will give us a blip in our levels of happiness, but very quickly we'll go back down to our base level? Will it decrease our motivation? Is that what we should teach kids? Because will they be motivated then? And the answer to that is that, yes, we will be. And again, this is backed up by a lot of studies. Once we understand that these things don't matter much, our motivation doesn't decrease, but it changes. In what way does it change? It changes from being dependent on the external, the status, the money, the grade, and moves toward the internal. On a personal level, I've seen it work as well. So I've not fully internalized, but I have moved more and more over the years to being more intrinsically motivated rather than extrinsically. It doesn't matter that status doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter that prestige or money doesn't matter to me. These things matter to me. I'm human. But I've moved more and more toward thinking about what is it that I really, really want to do with my life? Personally, intrinsically, what would I do, and this is a response paper that you're going to get the last week of class, what would I do in a world where no one knew what I was doing, where a spell of anonymity was cast on me? What would I do in such a world, intrinsically? No one would know about my achievements, success, and so on. And I ask these questions regularly. Again, all the response papers that you're getting, I've done many times. And what happens is that the motivation doesn't go away, it strengthens, but it strengthens in the direction of what makes us internally satisfied as opposed to satisfying the external. Can you see the difference? The motivation doesn't go away, but it changes from more extrinsic to more intrinsic. And when we are more intrinsically motivated, as we'll read later on in the semester, our levels of creativity go up, our success, goes up, and so on. Not to do away with extrinsic motivation. It's important and it's there, and you know, like the law of gravity, it exists, period. We care about what other people say to a lesser or greater degree. But if we strengthen the internal and as much as possible weaken or the external, because it won't make us happy in the long run, we will continue to work hard, probably work even harder. I work extremely hard and work harder today than I did in the past when it was mostly the extrinsic. And there's also research to back that up. And then Precious brought up a very interesting point that I didn't make the connection before, but it's similar to Vasco's and other people's points. She said, you know, it makes sense, the constrained versus the unconstrained. Remember worldview, that it's healthier to be with the constrained, you know, realizing. But she said, but what about striving for perfection? Isn't that a motivating, an important motivator for us to strive for perfection? And what she did essentially, again, I didn't make the connection before, but she connected this to something we're going to talk about after spring break when we talk about perfectionism. And what we're going to talk about, just to give a preview and a very brief answer to a difficult and important question, instead of striving for perfection, we're going to strive for excellence. The difference is that perfection is something that we can, that cannot be improved, that once we reach there, we're there. Excellence is about continuous improvement. It's about accepting failure, and we'll talk about accepting failure today. It's about giving ourselves the permission to be human. And what we find when we change our schema from pursuing perfection, from perfectionism toward excellence, not only do we become happier, less stressed, but we also are more successful. So it defeats the no pain, no gain approach. A few other things. Charlie brought up an important point after lecture as well. He says, what about those studies? Some of you may know, especially those of you who have taken Psych 15, social psychology, if you haven't, highly recommended. Or you may have even encountered in Psych 1. What about the illusion, positive illusions? Because I talked about the importance of being realistic, tied to reality, but there is a lot of research that shows that optimistic people often have positive illusions, and that it's the depressed people who are more realistic. And these are interesting studies. So what would I, Charlie asked, what would I say to that, having said that it's important to be tied to reality? Now this, for those of you in 1508, it also very much relates to what we're doing in 1508. When I say tied to reality, I don't mean tied to right now what's happening here. What I mean is tied to reality, broadly speaking, on the timeline, meaning. When Marva Collins looks at a child who's failing, the realistic approach, what most teachers do, is say, well, the child is failing, not very smart, not very successful. What she's doing, she's not just looking at the child right now in front of her. She's looking at the potential of the child. She is looking at what the child can be a year from now or 20 years from now. And that's as much part of reality. She's realistic, I would argue more realistic than the person who's just looking at the child right now, unable to read at the age of 8, unable to write, can hardly communicate coherently. And when they evaluate that child as that, they're being realistic, right? But is Marva Collins being unrealistic when she sees the potential, when she sees 1508, the seed in the child, and how that seed can grow? So that's very realistic, and that's the kind of realism that I'm talking about. It's not an illusion, it's very real. But that research is fascinating research for those of you who want to look at it, positive illusions, some great research there. And today's lecture we'll talk more about this idea, or probably next week, about what it means to be optimistic and realistic at the same time, as opposed to optimistic and Pollyannish, detached. I I want to say a few more words about the permission to be human. A lot of emails from you about this idea. To me, permission to be human, in many ways, is one of the pillars of a happy and fulfilling lives. Why? Because if we don't give ourselves the permission to be human, to experience negative emotions as well, then we'll just be frustrated. We'll be frustrated in the same way that an engineer will be frustrated if he or she doesn't accept the law of gravity as a given, as part of nature. Nature to be commanded must be obeyed, as Francis Bacon said. I want to tell you a story about my son when he was born. He's now 20 months old, and when he was born, I remember the excitement, and I was there in the delivery room, really the most unbelievable experience that I've ever had. And we were at Beth Israel Hospital. It was born at 1 a.m. At about 6 a.m. in the morning, my wife's doctor comes in. His name is Dr. Todd Shapiro, comes in to check her, to see that everything is okay with her and the baby. And, you know, he talks to us a little bit, and it was, thank God, a good, nice delivery, and everything was fine. And he walks out, and then as he walks out, he looks at us and he says, I've one advice for you. He says, over the next few months, you are going to experience every single kind of emotion there is, and you're going to experience it to the extreme. He said, you're going to experience ecstasy, you're going to experience agony. You're going to experience immense pleasure and pain. You're not going to be sleeping, you're going to be tired, and you're going to feel the most energetic in the world. You're going to feel jealousy and envy toward the child, and you're going to feel the most incredible emotions of love. You're going to be angry, and you're also going to feel the most benevolent and generous that you've ever felt. And he left. This was the most helpful advice I received about child rearing from anyone. Now, why was it so helpful? So my wife and I had been, you know, we'd been married for 4 years when, at that time, we've been, she was my high school sweetheart, so we'd been dating for, you know, for many years, not on and off at times, but for a long time. And I was always the central person in her life when we were together, and she in my life. And suddenly comes a 7.5-pound thing, and suddenly there's someone else who demands more attention even than I do, and who gets more attention than I do. Maybe I should cry more. And he's there, and my wife is no longer, I'm not the center of her existence anymore. And I experience jealousy and envy toward my baby. But then the next minute and the minute before, I experience this immense love toward my baby. Now, how would I feel about myself when I experience this great love toward my baby, knowing that just 5 minutes ago, I experienced envy toward him, like a schmuck, like a hypocrite? But then, at the back of my mind, there's Dr. Shapiro. You're going to experience every single kind of emotion. And what he was saying to me, in different words, was, it's human, it's natural. Everyone experiences these things. You're not a schmuck, in other words, right? And that allowed me, that permission to experience the negative emotions allowed me to experience the positive emotions fully. It doesn't just apply to child rearing. Because if we're unable to allow ourselves to experience the negative emotions, we're also not going to be able to experience the positive emotions when they come. Has anyone read Khalil Gibran, the prophet? One of my favorite books, beautiful poet, I think 19th century, from where today's Lebanon. And Khalil Gibran writes about the relationship between negative and positive emotions and how, he says it much, much more beautifully, how we need to experience the negative emotions in order to facilitate the experience of positive emotions. It's part of being human. And if we give ourselves the permission to experience one, we're much more likely to be able to fully experience the other. Which gets me to the next point, and this is a very good comment, and I'm glad you brought it up from Denise. And she said, you know, you said permission to be human, anxiety, I talked about anxiety, anger, depression, envy. I said, what about the permission to be human, permission to experience positive emotions? And, you know, for me it was implied, but it's not implied. I should have made it explicit, and I am making it explicit. We need to give ourselves the permission to experience the wonderful things in life as well, especially in today's world where there is a lot of cynicism, where positive emotions are scoffed at as, you know, naive, idealistic, detached, Pollyannish. We need to give ourselves the permission to be human in the positive as well, which takes me to the fifth premise. Do you remember what the fifth premise was, which is happiness is and ought to be our ultimate end? One of the main reasons why we don't give ourselves the permission to be happy is because we feel guilt. How can I allow myself to be happy when there are so many other unhappy people around the world? How can I allow myself to be happy when there's so much poverty and misery not far from where I live? And we feel guilty, and we don't give ourselves the permission to experience this happiness. And my argument in the fifth premise was that, remember the Buddha quote, that happiness can be shared. That happiness does not necessarily need to be a zero-sum game. It's not a zero-sum game. When I'm happier, it doesn't make other people less happy. The opposite is the case. And finally, the last point I want to touch on is a point brought up by Ada about creative depressives. And what she talks about is the examples of people who are depressed and are highly creative, which is absolutely right. I mean, Van Gogh and Proust are just two examples. There are many of them in history. One of the mistakes, and again, I should have clarified this in the lecture, so I'm doing it now. One of the things that positive psychologists, the mistake that they make as well, just like most people, is the error of the average. So they find a study where being happier, having positive emotions, makes people more creative. And then they say, happiness, positive emotions, is always good for creativity, which is not always the case. There are people who are depressed and are highly creative. What they are saying is that for convergent thinking, for the broaden and build, positive emotions are better, and overall they're better. This does not mean that there are no outliers here. It does not mean that there are no exceptions. It does not mean that if I'm depressed, and I've written some of my best work also when I was feeling down, but I find that I'm more energetic and more creative when I feel good. But again, it's not like, well, let me wait now until I'm happy before I start writing or before I start being creative. No, that's not the message that we need to take out of this research, but it is, and it can be misleading. So I'm glad Ada brought that point up. Okay, I think that's it. Barry, we're not gonna show the video today. We'll show it next time. So, what I want to talk about today is this idea of beliefs as self-fulfilling prophecies. I want to talk about the power of the mind and the power in general of psychology. I'm going to tell you a story now that I heard it first when I was 14, and that is what triggered my interest in psychology. That story is as a young aspiring athlete. Started playing squash when I was 11, so I was really into it by the time I was 14. This story really changed the way I look at the human mind, and it's through that I became interested in psychology and later positive psychology. The story is, and some of you probably know it, is about Roger Bannister. Roger Bannister was a runner, middle distance runner. He studied medicine at Oxford University, England, and he was around at a time when the mile was considered the most prestigious distance. There was a lot of almost aura, mysticism around the distance of the mile. So up until the year 1954, runners believed that the mile couldn't be completed in less than 4 minutes. Bless you. The best runners in the world ran the mile in 4 minutes and 2 seconds, 4 minutes and 3 seconds, around the 4 minute mark, getting close to it, but never breaking it. In fact, there were doctors who ran tests on runners, on athletes, and said that 4 minutes is the limit of human ability, that physiologically, we're unable to break the 4 minute barrier. Doctors and scientists showed that. And the runners proved that they were right, because no matter how hard they trained, no matter how hard they tried, they would run the mile just above the 4 minute mark. That's when Roger Bannister came onto the scene in the 1940s. He was then a student at the time at Oxford University, and he said, "This is nonsense. The mile can be run in under 4 minutes, and I'm going to be the one to do it." He was discarded as a dreamer, detached, especially given that he was running the mile at that time at 4 minutes and 12 seconds. That was his personal best. Good runner, you know, one of the best, but certainly not even close to the best in the world. But he continued to train, not harder than the other runners, but as hard as the top runners in the world, and he improved. But then he reached 4 minutes and 2 seconds, and he stopped, like all the other runners in the world. And the runners would say, you know, "We told you, great runner." You know, they had a lot of respect for him as a runner, world class, but a dreamer as far as the 4 minute barrier is concerned. He continued to train, he continued to say that it was possible. And then in April 1954, on his home turf at Oxford University, Roger Bannister ran the mile in 3 minutes and 59 seconds. Sensation. For those of you who were around then, you remember, sensation. Front page news all over the world. Science defied, doctors defied, the impossible made possible. It became known as the Dream Mile. But listen to this. So remember, for decades, since the time they started measuring runs, no one could break the 4 minute barrier. It was considered impossible. 6 weeks later, an Australian runner by the name of John Landy runs the mile in 3 minutes and 58 seconds. During the same year, 1954, 37 runners run the mile in under 4 minutes. 1955, over 300 runners break the 4 minute barrier. And the year after, they stopped counting because so many runners broke that barrier. What happened? New equipment? No. Started to train in a different way? No. The mind. The power of the mind. And what Roger Bannister did, what he did when he broke the 4 minute barrier, is he broke a fort. Not a physical fort, but a mental one, a mental barrier. And suddenly it became possible. Today, the world record, I believe, is 3 minutes and 46 seconds. And continues to improve. The power of the mind. You can see why this story captured my mind as a young athlete, showing how important it is to believe in success. Now, here is what I want to do today and next time. This is a two-part lecture. I want to share with you research. Actual rigorous research that explains what is it about the mind, what is it about belief that actually shape reality. I want to share with you the mechanism of how it actually works. What Roger Bannister did and what happened inside here for thousands of runners and millions of people around the world right after that. But then I also want to talk about some caveats, because just saying to someone, be optimistic and believe, that's not enough. That's pop psychology. It doesn't really work. So we're going to talk about actual research that shows how do we find realistic optimism, optimism that can help. And finally, and we're not going to get this to this today, but next time, most importantly, how do we raise our beliefs? What are some of the techniques that we can actually use in our lives, whether it's using our imagination, whether it's using some techniques from cognitive behavioral therapy, whether it's behaving in certain ways that will lead us to believe more in ourselves. Because these things can change. And we'll talk about the research that illustrates this. In other words, what I want to show today is the scientific behind what has been considered for many years a mystical statement by the Buddha. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make our world. Maybe not fully, and of course there are external circumstances, there are limitations. But to a great extent, we create our world through our beliefs, through our self-concept, through our expectations of the future. Whether it's of other people, remember, do we see the seed in the child or not, but also of ourselves. Who did that with their minds? So, anyone want to sing in the meantime? Any volunteers? Jessica? Okay. So the first story I wanna begin with, which will lead to the research, is a story that also had a lot of impact on me, on my thinking, and also had a lot of impact on research in psychology. I agree with you. You're gonna get to see some pictures of him soon. Now, before I had a child, I would get all these emails from parents with all the pictures, and I would say, God, they're so cheesy. And yep. So the first story I want to talk about is the story of Pygmalion. Here is the source of the word Pygmalion. Pygmalion was a Greek, this is part of Greek mythology, was a Greek sculptor. And what Pygmalion did was he came, you know, to the ripe age of, I guess it was 18 then at the time, and he looked for a wife. He looked for a woman with whom he could share his life. He looked in Athens for the woman, couldn't find her. He went out of Athens to other parts of the, you know, the Greek Empire and couldn't find her. He went everywhere, searched the entire known world at the time, and couldn't find his ideal woman, the woman that he had envisioned, that he had imagined. And he went back home to Athens. The problem for Pygmalion then was clearly that it was before 1636, or I should say before 1879, when Radcliffe came onto the scene. He would have certainly found her then, but he was born at the wrong time, in the wrong place. So he kept on searching and couldn't find her until he decided that instead of finding that woman, he will create a sculpture. He was a very talented sculptor. He would create a sculpture in the image of his ideal woman. And he created that sculpture and he worked on it day and night. And when he finally was able to finish his masterwork, he looked up at the sculpture and he began to cry. He fell in love with the sculpture, but it was not real. Zeus, Athena, especially Aphrodite, looked down at him, took pity on him, and what they did was breathe life into the marble. And they lived happily ever after. This is a painting. I forget the art. Anyone remember the artist's name? It's a German artist. This is the myth of Pygmalion. The sculpture came to life. Now, this myth of Pygmalion was then taken and made into a play by George Bernard Shaw called Pygmalion, later into a musical, My Fair Lady, where the idea is that the doctor, Dr. Higgins, takes a flower girl and makes her into a lady so that she can interact with, you know, kings, queens, and royalty. It was a very important play because what it was a challenge on you're being born into a certain class, and also a challenge for being a merit-founded society. What happened in the story, which is interesting, is that ultimately she transformed him more than he transformed her. A beautiful story, but again, the idea of Pygmalion. So it's with this idea of Pygmalion from the history of literature that Robert Rosenthal approached the classroom. He was here before you came here. He was the head of the department for many years. And when I was a graduate student, it was his last year. Now he's in California. He was misled, thinking that California would make him happier. You know, he's there with his grandchildren. That's why he moved. And what he did was take this idea of beliefs, believing in something, whether it's in a flower girl or in a sculpture or in oneself, and he brought it to the classroom. And here is his study, brilliant study, published back in 1967, should be taught to every single teacher in the world. Unfortunately, not many teachers know it. This is what he did. He went into classrooms between first grade and fourth grade, and he gave the students tests, and he told the teachers that what these tests were measuring was whether they were fast spurters or not. Fast spurter meaning that they are now at a stage in their life when they're going to make a big leap forward in terms of their cognitive abilities. And he said, this is a test devised at Harvard, just the latest and best. And then he went on and told the teachers which students were actually fast spurters, which children over the next year were going to make a big cognitive leap forward in their studies. Now, unbeknownst to the teachers, the test that he took was regular IQ test. He didn't even look at the scores at that time. He used it later. And he arbitrarily told the teachers who the fast spurters were. Complete random design. And he said to the teachers, one more thing, you cannot tell the students that they are fast spurters or they're not, because we don't want to hurt anyone. But just so you know, that's all he said, and he left, coming back at the end of the year. And here is what he found at the end of the year. These fast spurters, random sample from the class, these fast spurters started to perform better and continued to perform better for as long as they remained with him in terms of evaluation. They performed better in the humanities. They also performed better in math, in objective tests. Here is the most amazing thing. He measured their IQ again at the end of the year, and the fast spurter's IQ actually increased significantly. Now, IQ is usually considered to be stable, right? You're born with your intelligence quotient. You're born with it and you die with it. What this study showed was that their IQ actually changed over that year, and the teachers weren't allowed to tell them that they were very smart or fast spurters, but it was all the nonverbals, the attention that they gave them, the belief in these students. Remember we talked about practical idealism? How many teachers know about this study? And the same question asks, how many people know about Marvel? Marvel Collins knows about this study, can be sure of that. She lives it every single day. For her, everyone is a fast spurter. But most teachers don't know it. And this has to be out there. They've replicated this in the workplace as well. So they told managers, they ran these tests, psychometric tests, these are your workers with the most potential. These workers actually became the best workers. Absenteeism level went down. These workers didn't know that the boss had just received this information, but they became more committed to the workplace because of that. Because the boss communicated more belief in them. It doesn't have to be expenses. It doesn't have to be showering with praise. Oh, you're so smart. A lot of it are subtle cues saying, I believe in you. Think about these implications for relationships, for our interpersonal relationships. Think about it for your role as a future parent, as an older sibling, as a child to your parents, because you know what? It works both ways. It works both ways. Jamieson, in a fascinating study, did this instead of from the teacher to the students, from the students to the teacher. Went into random classrooms and divided, where the teacher was teaching a few classes, and divided the classes into two. One group was the control group. He said nothing to them. Sorry, it's a she. And the other group, she said, this teacher has been rated very highly by students and by us, the researchers. That's all. At the end of the semester, that teacher was rated higher. The students paid more attention and were more committed to the class, and the students' grades were higher. In other words, if you want to do well in 1504, we the teaching staff, incredible, isn't it? The power of beliefs, the power of the mind, and how it influences reality. Goethe, treat a man as he is and he will remain as he is. Treat a man as he can and should be and he shall become as he can and should be. Beliefs are self-fulfilling prophecies. Our expectations become reality of other people, whether it's a student or a teacher, whether it's a parent or a child, whether it's an employee or a boss. Those of you in 1508, we're going to devote two entire classes just to this idea in the workplace and the importance role of a leader and a follower in terms of expectations and beliefs. I want to move on a little bit now to another set of studies that also communicate the power of the mind. And these are the studies that talk about the power of the situation. Most of you have learned, who have taken Psych 1, Psych 15, or who have read something about psychology, know about the studies that basically spawned social psychology, showing the power of the situation. Studies by Ash, the most famous one probably, Milgram's Obedience to Authority, when an individual would shock a complete stranger with heart problems to the point of extreme danger, even though the stranger begged to stop, Why? Because an authority figure, a doctor, or what they thought was a doctor with a white coat, told them that the experiment must go on. The power of the situation. Just Google Milgram if you haven't seen it. You'll read about fascinating studies showing how so many of us are susceptible to the power of authority, to obedience, and are likely to be obedient. So that's one study. Another very famous study, many of you probably know, Zimbardo's prison experiment, that can in many ways explain what happened at Abu Ghraib. What happened there was, this was run at Stanford, where some students randomly assigned to being prisoners, other students randomly assigned to being the wardens, to running that prison. And within a few hours, they entered these roles so completely that the wardens were actually humiliating and beating the prisoners, and the prisoners themselves took on the role of being prisoners, even though it was all role-playing, a game, an experiment. The experiment was supposed to go on for 2 weeks. It was stopped after a week because it became dangerous. Regular Stanford students, because of the power of the situation. So these are fascinating studies, important studies. We need to understand them. They focus, again, on the negative. And what psychology has done was mostly focus on these, while not focusing, not thinking about, not researching the positive that a situation can elicit in people, the good things that a situation can do. Not, again, not to discard the negative. The Milgram experiments are very important. Zimbardo's experiments are so relevant today. We need to understand them, but at the same time, the pendulum can't just be on the negative. We need to also understand the positive. So, what is the positive power of the situation? The most important work in this area was done by our very own Professor Alan Langer, to my mind, one of the, if not the most important, living psychologist. And she did some fascinating work in the realm of positive situations. Let me share with you just two of them. There are many more, and she talks about them in her books that I highly recommend. One of them is, her latest one is On Becoming an Artist, and the other one is Mindfulness. And it's in Mindfulness that she talks about this study. So here was the study. Her sample were all men who were 75 years or older. And what she did was bring them to a retreat. This was in 1979, and she brought them to a retreat where they pretended that it was 1959, that it was actually 20 years earlier. And what she did on that retreat for these men was, she had magazines from exactly 20 years before. She had daily newspapers from 20 years earlier. The music that was playing was the Opportunes. It was from 20 years earlier. And the entire environment, even they had pictures, IDs of them 20 years earlier. They would talk as if it was 20 years earlier, took on the role, just like Zimbardo taking on the role. They took on the role of being actually younger. And what they found was incredible. Their mental and biological age actually decreased. Let me mention a few things that she found. First, in terms of the length of their fingers. As you age, the fingers actually get shorter. Within a week, the length of the fingers extended. Within a week, she measured flexibility, they became more flexible. Within a week, their hearing and their sight improved significantly. Within that week, their levels of intelligence increased. Their memory increased, improved. Going back home, they became more self-reliant, better able to take care of themselves. they became younger. Physically, actual physical measures of fitness and mentally. Why? Because before they were in an environment where what do we communicate to the elderly? You need to be taken care of, you're weak. Whereas they went into an environment where they became young again. And these changes persisted. Look at the power of the mind. Roger Bannister, Alan Langer showing it. This is what bridging between the ivory tower and Main Street is all about. Oh, also they were judged to be younger, significantly younger on pictures that were taken before and after, and also their muscle strength increased during that week. The power of the mind. Here's another cute study that also Professor Langer ran. This was back in 1989. She went, or she took her subjects into a simulator, a flight simulator. And what she did was she measured their eyesight. You know those normal charts that you put on the wall, regular charts? She measured their eyesight before the experiment, and she had a control group that also measured after. And there was no difference between measuring it now and measuring it an hour later. They were pretty consistent about eyesight. But then she took a group, the experimental group, and she took them to this simulator. She dressed them up as pilots, the whole gear. She actually took them into a flight simulator, and they played around with the simulator, learning how to maneuver the plane and so on. It was a jet fighter plane. And then, when they were dressed as pilots within the simulator, she had them take that same eye test, exact same eye test, same size letters that the control group had, all the same. 40% of the subjects, their eyesight improved significantly. Amazing. Just because they were put in a positive situation. Why? Because we associate fighter pilots with people who can see well. Right? I knew from a very young age I couldn't be a fighter pilot because of my glasses. Now, this is the stigma that people have. So they assume the role of a fighter pilot, and their eyesight actually improves for 40% of them, not all. The power of the positive situation. Let me move on to another fascinating line of studies, some of my favorite there. Studies on priming. What is priming? Very much related to what Professor Langer did, in terms of putting people and priming them to actually believe in themselves more. What these studies do, they prime you to something positive or negative, either implicitly, so you see something flashing on the screen too fast for you to actually register it, or explicitly, where you actually get to write something and you're primed to think in a certain direction. And I'll give you some examples. Most of the priming literature is on the negative. For example, you're primed with certain stereotypes, either of old people, stereotypes that people have about race and gender. And the purpose of a lot of these studies is to show that we have these stereotypes, we have prejudices, and that all we need to do is prime a prejudice for it to actually manifest itself in behavior. And those of you who took social psych, I'm sure, covered this. Now, the work of Claude Steele, from Stanford, about stereotype threats, and also work that I'm sure you covered in social psychology. If you took it, some work being done here by Professor Daniel Wagner on automaticity and control, Barge. Barge runs fascinating experiments. Let me give you just one example. He brings people into his office and primes them with words of the elderly, words associated with the elderly. Words such as sentimental, words such as old, words such as Florida. Anyone here from Florida? No. Words such as wrinkles, words that we associate with the elderly. And people don't know that they're part of an experiment where he's priming them. He does it as if it's part of another experiment where they, you know, write about the elderly or see certain words. And then what he does, compared to a control group, have them take intelligence tests, memory tests. And what they do, they actually perform worse on these intelligence tests with these simple primes. Why? Because we have a stereotype of the elderly. Their memory is not so good anymore. They're not as quick anymore. And here's the other measure that what he did. He actually measured the time that it took the subjects to get from where they sat down on their computer and did the tests to the elevator. Those who were primed with words of the elderly actually walked slower and more hunched down than those who were not. Subconscious, completely, they had no idea what they were in for. This can be primed on the subconscious level or much more consciously. But it doesn't only have to do with negative stereotypes, as Professor Langer shows. We can also use it for the positive, which Barge did. He primed people with words that are associated with achievement, thriving, success, persistence and hard work, motivation. He primed them with these words. And then he gave them the same tests. Again, control group versus this group. Those who were primed with achievement words did better on the test, their memory improved, they persisted for longer in trying to solve these problems, they did better. With simple primes, completely not consciously, because one experiment, he asked them to find synonyms for the word achievement. And he said, because we want to run a study on it, and we need your help before you start the actual study, which was an intelligence test. Amazing. Here's another incredible study. Dijksterhuis and van Knippensberg. You get 2 extra points on your final if you can pronounce that. So, just kidding, don't. Here's the study that they did. They had 3 groups where they primed their subjects with stereotypes of professors, stereotypes of secretaries, and stereotypes of soccer. This is done in Europe. I think they're Dutch. And stereotypes of hooligans, soccer hooligans. And they had to write, once again, for another study, not for this study, so they thought, they had to write about these 3 groups. Each group had to write about, for 5 minutes, how would you characterize a professor? How would you characterize a secretary? How would you characterize a soccer hooligan? In other words, what they were priming them with things that they associated with professors. Going to tell a joke and I decided not to. Sorry. Because you would have been laughing at me and I don't want that. So, here is what they found. Usually the stereotypes associated with professors usually are positive when associated with intelligence. These people did better on intelligence tests, better on memory tests, better on creativity tests. Compared to the secretaries, the group that did the worst were the soccer hooligans, even though they didn't know it was even associated with what they were going to do later on in the test. So what are these studies, amazing studies, show us? They show us how important the environment is, that even on the subconscious level, what we see around us, even if we don't register it consciously, what we write about, what we do, influences our mood, influences even our demeanor in terms of how we walk, influences our intelligence and how much we think and how much we persist. Do you remember in the second lecture, I think I talked about the Heisenberg principle as it applies to negative research? When we only do negative research, we're constantly priming ourselves with negative things. When what we read about is mostly depression and anxiety, we prime ourselves. Not to say that these things are not important, they're very important, but we need to shift the pendulum so that there is at least a balance between the positivity and the negativity. I pay a lot of attention to creating my environment. In fact, I brought my environment with me today. Think about your working environment where you spend a lot of time. Do you have positive things around you, things that motivate you, things that bring up positive thoughts? Things like people you love, or places that you enjoy. So I have on my wall next to me, and as I said, I brought my environment with me. So I have pictures, many pictures of, you know, this is my family. You can see from the back, right? This is a picture of my baby. This is the first time he walked. It was actually in Phil Stone's house. First time he ever walked. So I have this right next to me reminding me, you know, my wife and my kid, my son and me riding on a tractor together. A lot of fun. So I have these pictures right next to me. I really do. Marva Collins, right next to me. Yeah, really. My inspiration, why I teach. I have other things, pleasant objects, memorabilia. So I have right next to me flags of my two favorite countries in the world, countries that I'm most grateful for. I have a flag of my country, Israel, and I have a flag of America right next to me. I also have great art on my wall. I have a favorite artist. Here is a picture from his earlier works. So, can you see? Yeah. He has a sale next week in Sotheby's, if you're interested. And this is his later works. You can see a different motif. It's more. He's going more into sculpting and, yeah, some ice cream sticks. Yeah. Anyway. My entire room is full of them. Why? Because every time I smile when I look at them. I can't help it. And it puts a positive, you know, and even after a while you stop seeing things, especially when they're right next to you, it still influences you on the subconscious level. I have really great art on my walls. So my favorite sculptor is Rodin. Here is, you know, the thinker. And I have another piece by him to remind me that it's not only about thinking, there are other important things in life. The Kiss, you know that painting? Anyway, two people making love. So I have also other things that I have. You know, I've become that kind of father, right? Quotes. You know that I love quotes, right? So let me share with you some of the quotes. Again, taking them down from my wall. Camus, in the depth of winter, I finally learned that there was within me an invincible summer. A quote that really inspires me. And I have them, and I printed them out large, and I put it on my board. John Quincy Adams, patience and perseverance have a magical effect before which difficulties disappear and obstacles vanish. Thoreau, if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams, and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. The power of the mind. I have this in front of me every day. George Eliot, Marianne Evans. The important work of moving the world forward does not wait to be done by perfect men. Something that really helps me to think about. You know? Just work, just do it. It doesn't have to be perfect. And my favorite quote, Margaret Mead's, anthropologist. Many of you probably know this one. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. So these are the inspirational quotes that I have around me. This is my work environment. And even if I don't see them every day because they've been there for a long time, they have an impact. They prime my thinking. Okay. Shift gears. These are fascinating studies, and the question is, what do you do with these studies? Do you actually implement them? It's not that hard. Print your favorite quotes. Don't just have it as a file. I know many of us have files with quotes. Print them out and stick them on your wall. Pictures, stick them on the wall. Great art. Go to Sotheby's next week. Let me move now to the self-help movement. And I want to say a few things about it because in many ways the self-help movement came from this idea of the power of the mind. This was the genesis of the self-help movement when people realized that their thoughts were influencing reality. And the most famous book, the book that brought to people's consciousness this idea of how much the mind affects you, is Think and Grow Rich. Many of you have this book at home. Over the years, it has sold more than 60 million copies, much more than 7 journal articles, right? 60 million copies, and it continues to be one of the best sellers on Amazon. I think it was published in the 1930s. And what was the message of Think and Grow Rich? Whatever your mind can conceive and believe, it can achieve. The American dream. It's all up to you. You can do it with persistence, and if you imagine it enough, it will actually come true. What a message. And people bought this message. They wanted to believe it. And many people told, my success came as a result of this. Henry Ford, the industrialist, whether you think you can or can't, you are right. So this message was internalized by business people. It was internalized by people from all over the world. I spent a lot of time living in Asia, specifically in Singapore and in India. This book and other books like it are bestsellers there also. These books have changed the world, the way people think about the power of the mind. Another very famous one, The Power of Positive Thinking. Here is what Vincent Peale says. Have great hopes and dare to go all out for them. Have great dreams and dare to live them. Have tremendous expectations and believe in them. And people believed in that message. They wanted to believe in this message. But here is the question. Here is the important question. Is there substance behind this? So we read these books, many of them are very well written, inspiring. You feel like you want to conquer the world after reading them, but is there substance to it? Well, what research psychology has found is that to a great extent, yes, not fully in terms of whatever you believe and conceive you can achieve, not fully, but to a great extent, yes. And some of the studies that we talked about show this. If your mind can believe and conceive the 4-minute mile, you're much more likely to achieve it than if it cannot. This doesn't mean that everyone in this room can do a 4-minute mile if we just believe and conceive it. You know, there are certain limitations. But to a great extent, there is a lot of truth to the message of these books. And no one brought this message home more clearly than Albert Bandura, professor at Stanford, now very much involved with the positive psychology network of scholars, has done work for many years on the concept of self-efficacy. And what he did essentially was bring the scientific rigor to the fun of the self-help movement. And let me read to you one sentence or one quote that summarizes literally decades of research on it. Beliefs in personal efficacy affect life choices, level of motivation, quality of functioning, resilience to adversity, and vulnerability to stress and depression. All these things are affected by how much we believe in ourselves. People who regard themselves as highly efficacious, i.e., who believe in themselves, act, think, and feel differently from those who perceive themselves as inefficacious. They produce their own future rather than simply foretell it. In other words, going back a lecture, they become the scribes in their own lives, determining their future by what they believe And note what he says. They act, they behave differently, their thought patterns are differently, and they feel differently. They're happier. Very important stuff, but not as important as the final thing that he shows through decades of research, which is that we can cultivate it over time. It's not that, well, I was born believing in myself, and that's my base level, and that's where I'm stuck. Or I don't believe in myself, and it's such a pity, because that means I can't act, feel, and think differently. That's not what he showed, and next time we're going to talk about the research that he came up with of how we can actually cultivate higher levels of belief in ourselves. It can actually change. Also, Curry, in her research on college athletes, showed that hope, the belief that things will turn out well, accounted for 56% of the variance of an athlete's success once you control for other things. So, of course, it doesn't matter how much I believe that I can be, you know, a good addition to the football team, it will probably not work for various reasons that I will not go into right now. But it probably won't work no matter what the belief is. But 56% of the variance, once you start, is accounted for by how much you believe, how well you believe you can do. Nathaniel Brandon, whom you're reading, over 40 years of working as a therapist, as a researcher, as a thinker in the field, very much bridges between rigor and fun, accessibility and yet depth. And here is what he says in his book, and you're going to read the book for this class. The level of our self-esteem, i.e. how much we believe in ourselves, has profound consequences for every aspect of our existence, how we operate in the workplace, how we deal with people, how we are likely to rise, how much we are likely to achieve, and in the personal realm, with whom we are likely to fall in love, how we interact with our spouse, children, and friends, what level of personal happiness we attain. Because what he showed, and what other people showed through their research, is that if we have low levels of self-esteem, if we don't believe that we are worthy of happiness, we don't give ourselves the permission to be happy, and that is one of the things that many people with low self-esteem have, no matter what we achieve, no matter what we attain, we will never be happy. Yeah, we'll experience a blip in our happiness and feel good about ourselves, but it will go down very quickly. And what he does in his work, and what he talks about in his book, is how can we raise the base level of happiness? Because you know what? There is no correlation, as I mentioned last time, between the external circumstances and happiness, or very low correlation, and only in extreme cases. But there is very high correlation between self-esteem and happiness. That's part of the research that I did. It was over 0.7 correlation between happiness and self-esteem, whether or not we believe in ourselves. And the great thing about it is that we can change it, that it's not a fixed level. So we may not work on happiness directly, but we can actually work on happiness directly, but we're going to work on self-esteem and cultivating it directly in this class. And what he says is that self-concept, how we look at the world, what our self-concept is about ourselves, is destiny. What we believe is very often what actually happens. Have a wonderful long weekend. See you next week.